From Portland, Oregon, this is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rockney Roll. Coming up this episode, this evening marks the beginning of Sukkot, the seven-day festival of dwelling in a hut, shaking a luav and etrog, and experiencing joy with family and friends. But a deeper look into the holiday and its meaning reveals even more. For just that purpose, I spoke with Adina Miller, a Jewish educator and the program director at TVNU Building Justice, the Jewish Gap Year program working hands-on to improve the lives of Portland's most disadvantaged residents. We go over some Sukkot basics, how TVNU's work connects deeply with the ideals and values of this festival, and how you can bring some of that meaning into your own celebrations. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting an evening with Dara Horn, Monday, October 28th, at the Middleman Jewish Community Center in Portland. The award-winning author of several best-selling books, Horn will speak about the realities of anti-Semitism and how it's addressed in a post-October 7th world. Get your tickets online by October 21st at jewishportland.org/Dara Horn. Now, here's Adina Miller. Adina Miller, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Rockney.
Well, thanks for coming. Tell me about your Jewish journey.
Well, I grew up in a home where Jewish was everything. We once went to visit friends who lived in Hartford, Connecticut, when I was an adult. And their kid said to me, "So if you live in New Haven, Connecticut," which I did at the time, "are you a fan of the Yankees or of the Red Sox?" And I said, "Well, neither, but, you know, I didn't grow up here." And he said, "Where'd you grow up?" And I said, "Oh, well, I lived in Washington, D.C. when I was a kid." "Oh, so were you a Senators fan?" "No." "And then I lived in Philadelphia." "Oh, so you were a Phillies fan?" "No." "And then we lived in New York Mets or Yankee?" "No." And I went through all the places I'd lived, and he said, "Who are you a fan of?" And I was like, Shabbat. In my house, we grew up fans of Shabbat, and that's really how my Jewish life was. My father was a rabbi of a congregation. My mother was eventually a principal of a Jewish day school and then an educator in college and post-college programs, and Jewish and Jewish education were just part of everything we did. And I fought it for a little while. I didn't think I was going to go into education or Jewish stuff, but eventually it sucked me in. And even my sister, who rejected it at the age of about four, is now in Jewish education. So eventually it led me to graduate school in Jewish studies and Jewish history, and then to working in a Jewish boarding school. And I decided I didn't like taking attendance and I didn't like forcing people to go to services. But what I really did like was helping people connect in ways that helped them express their Jewishness in a multitude of ways, especially through social involvement and involvement in justice causes. And so when I saw the ad to come to Portland to become the program director of TVNU Building Justice Gap Year program, picked up my family and we moved across the country, and here we are.
Fabulous. Though I have to point out that of the many good things you can say about Shabbat, and I can say plenty, Shabbat has never been to the World Series.
But has the World Series been to Shabbat? That's the question.
Ask Sandy Koufax. So we're here to talk about Sukkot, so let's get some of the basics out of the way, because there's a lot of basics to go over. What is Sukkot? What is a sukkah, or what makes a sukkah, and what are the plants that get shaken in the sukkah?
Yeah. So Sukkot is a fall festival in the Jewish tradition. It has kind of two origins. One is the agricultural, which is the fall harvest festival. It's kind of the end of the bringing in all the summer crops, including the grape harvest, which is possibly what makes it the supposed to be the happiest festival of all. It's sometimes referred to as just the holiday, the festival, Chag, and you are commanded to be happy on Sukkot. So forced happiness, we're all in favor of that. So the harvest festival is the agricultural route, and then there's also kind of the historical reason for it, if you can call it that, which is that as it says in the Torah, that as the children of Israel were leaving Egypt, they dwelled in booths in Sukkot. Sukkot is the plural of sukkah, which means a booth, a hut, a temporary structure of some kind. And we are commanded to dwell in these booths for 7 days in order to remember that that's what the Israelites did. P.S. The rabbis noticed that it says in the Torah, they actually lived in tents, not in booths, but they kind of sweep that under the rug.
details.
So maybe we should all be pitching tents in our backyards instead. So Sukkot is this seven-day festival, and then on the eighth day, there's a tacked-on extra super special holiday called Shmini Atzeret that nobody knows about, which is the eighth day of Atzeret, which maybe means assembly or stop right there, but it's kind of like a bonus holiday. You've gotten through all these other holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, have one extra day off from work.
Nice. Which then bleeds right into Simchat Torah.
Right. And in Israel and in Reform communities around the world, those are the same day, Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah. And then in other traditions, they're two separate days, one right after the other.
Bonus holiday.
Exactly. So a sukkah is this temporary structure, and maybe it remembers where we dwelled in the wilderness, and maybe it is a reminder of the kinds of huts that you might see in a field during harvest time. If you have a particularly big field and it doesn't make sense to come and go from your home to the fields as you harvest, you might erect a little hut for harvest season. And so that little hut, you know, has grown into a huge tradition of building Sukkot in people's backyards, on the roof, on the porch, on the back of a flatbed truck, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, ancient rabbis have a conversation about, could you build it on a camel? Could you use an elephant as one wall of your sukkah? They were quite creative as well about these questions, so it's not a new thing.
What were the verdicts on those two particular questions?
I think it depends on whether it's alive and whether it's tied down. Those are the questions.
Okay.
Also, whether it's the kind of animal matters, and our friend Beth Berkowitz wrote a whole academic paper about this, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So, and on Sukkot, you're supposed to dwell in these huts. It's supposed to be your primary residence, and your inside house kind of is your temporary residence. So you should sleep in it. You should eat all your meals in it. You should do your homework in it, all those kinds of things. Pacific Northwest weather aside, it does say in the rabbinic writings of ancient times that if it rains to the point where your oatmeal gets watery or you're generally uncomfortable, then you don't have to go eat in the sukkah because it should be a place of joy and enjoyment.
Thank heavens.
It doesn't talk about bees, but we have had that interfere with our enjoyment in this century.
We'll come back to that.
And then the four species, or arba aminim, the four kinds, are this group of vegetation that we hold and shake around. And the lulav and the etrog are kind of the collective names for the two. Mm-hmm. The lulav is a palm frond, and kind of bound to it with a woven palm is a set of willow leaves, willow branches, and myrtle branches. And the etrog is a citron. It's from the citrus family. And you might see a Buddha's hand around Portland these days because we're into funkier things. And they're all related, lemons and citrons and so on. An etrog is pretty thick-fleshed and has very little of the kind of pulp inside. And it has a beautiful smell. And in fact, there's a bracha, a blessing that you can say, specifically for smelling good things. It's different than the smelling good things blessing we say on a Saturday night as we say goodbye to Shabbat through the Havdalah ritual. It's specifically for smelling good fruit. So you do a little scratch and sniff, you can throw an extra blessing in your day.
Oh, very nice. We talked about some of the origins and roots of the holiday. What is its really deep significance beyond it just being a mitzvah from the Torah to observe this seven-day festival?
Yeah. So, you know, for a lot of traditional people, the idea that it reminds you of leaving Egypt and the transition from slavery to freedom is enough. And for a lot of traditional Jews, the connection with ancient agricultural practices is enough. But it's not for everybody. And I believe pretty strongly in everyone being able to access Jewishness in their own ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that Sukkot is a fabulous entry holiday. If you're not concerned with all the rules and regulations about how to build a kosher sukkah, put that aside. Having time where you and your family and your friends, your chosen family, whoever it is, get to sit outside and have a picnic. What a great idea that the Jewish tradition said, you've got to do this. And they said, the fall foliage, don't just look at it, build it into your sukkah so that the roof of a sukkah is supposed to be from greenery or, you know, plant matter that has grown is no longer attached to the ground. So you don't want to build it under a tree. That's cheating because it's already there for you. But if you cut down some of those branches, then you have a beautiful fall roof, a green roof, the original living roof, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's one reason to celebrate Sukkot, is just to enjoy the autumn, enjoy being outside. Of course, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I guess it's not autumn. Even better, have a nice spring holiday. And enjoy sitting around a table and singing and eating and relishing each other's company. I think that's one way. And another is that the themes of Sukkot are really important to a lot of people now in 21st century Portland, Oregon. You know, the connection to the land and to where our food comes from is back in vogue, right? And not just for everybody, but, you know, even within the Jewish community, kind of Jewish farming practices and Jewish farming collectives have made a resurgence. And there are lots of different Jewish farm programs that you can take part in. You know, we've got some of our alumni from our program who work at Zumwalt Acres, which is a Jewish collective farm in outside Chicago. And there's the Urban Adama program in the Bay Area. And there's, you know, all kinds of programs like this. And Jews who have been farmers, maybe not in a few generations, have this chance to kind of reconnect. And if you're not going to go start a farm, then this is a chance to have a week where you are more cognizant of the connection with where our food comes from and the harvest in general and with the seasons and with the earth. And I think that that's very appealing to a lot of people. You know, one of the things that people use to decorate their sukkah is kind of the seven species of food that the ancient land of Israel was known for. So these are wheat, barley, pomegranates, olives, grapes, figs, dates, things like that. Mm-hmm. And one thing I like to do with my participants who come from all over the United States, and now Mexico, actually, is to have them introduce themselves to our guests, not only with their names and pronouns, because it's 2024, but also with what would your homeland be known for? What's a food that your home country is known for? Even, or it might be a lobster roll if they're from Maine, you know, but to recognize that we all have things that are like locally our specialties and local produce that is, that we're known for, and to kind of connect in that way. So the seven species of the land of Israel might not be a thing for you, but maybe a hoagie is if you're from Philly or something like that.
I don't imagine we'll be decorating a sukkah with a lobster roll for many reasons.
Yes, well, they're perishable. But, you know, you could, a lot of people use plastic fruits, so maybe you find a plastic lobster roll.
So can you tell me a little more about the work Tivnu is doing in Portland and elsewhere and how that connects to Sukkot beyond just the, hey, we're building things. Hey, Sukkot is a holiday about building this temporary dwelling in your yard and living in it. Because there's a deeper connection there, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. So Tivnu is this Jewish program. It's a gap year program. That's our main program, but we also do short programs as well. It's primarily gap year program, so 17 to 20-year-olds from all over. Now we're talking about the continent. And they come spend 9 months in Portland. They live in a couple of houses in Northeast. And they spend their work days either working on our construction crew, where we mostly work with tiny house villages and other kinds of infrastructure for people who are living outside to help build up their communities alongside them. Or they work at internships that are different social justice organizations around Portland, not particularly Jewish organizations, but organizations like Street Roots or Street Books or, you know, Title I schools like Boise Elliott Elementary and Alliance High School. They work at Columbia SLU Watershed Council, at PAW Team, all kinds of different things. And I help set up each of their internships in a field that they're interested in and that really contributes to the landscape of social change here in Portland. There are over 70 organizations we've now worked with for internships. And most of our participants do a combination. They'll spend a couple days a week at the internship and a couple days on construction. And then they live together and they form a community and they celebrate Shabbat and holidays together. And we do an educational program where we learn about different social justice topics from local, national, and Jewish perspectives. We bring in all kinds of speakers. We do some field trips. And then we do trips around the Pacific Northwest. They were at Tahoma or Mount Rainier at the beginning of the year. We'll be at the coast. We'll be in the desert. We'll go to Mount Hood and play in the snow. So all kinds of different exposures to the Pacific Northwest. And I think that there are a lot of great tie-ins with Sukkot for Tivnu. The first is, as you said, building. Tivnu means build in the imperative. And in addition to learning construction skills and being able to use those, they really are talking about building community, building up their Jewish identities, building up their resumes for professional life, building up their kind of perspectives on what's going on in the world. And Sukkot helps connect in all those ways. And they definitely build their own sukkah. And sometimes over the years, we've helped other folks build their Sukkot as well. But I would say that the two biggest themes of Sukkot that connect with Tivnu are this connection to the land and the fragility of our housing. So the connection to the land is what I was talking about before, and a lot of our participants spend their internship working in some kind of farming or gardening. They've worked with Kindness Farm a lot, with Zenger Farm, with Learning Gardens Lab, with Growing Gardens, which is a school-based program. And in each of these places, they're learning about regenerative agricultural practices. They're learning about ways to have the earth give a bounty without stripping the earth of its resources. They're learning about honoring traditional practices and reclaiming them, and the science behind it also. So there's that really wonderful connection, and a lot of people who come through Tivnu find that connection with actually growing food and teaching others to grow food and teaching others about how to treasure that connection is really very strong. And then the last one is possibly the most important. We're living in these temporary structures. You're not allowed to, according to the rules, you're not allowed to have a permanent sukkah, you know, and you don't have a roof over it that's going to shelter you from the elements, right? It's just greenery up there. My husband's from California. He thought you could only use palm fronds for that. And I grew up mostly on the East Coast where palm fronds were not an option.
Nope, not happening.
I lived in Minnesota for a couple years. We did not have a sukkah with palm fronds on the roof.
No, you did not, unless you flew them in.
So, you know, these are temporary structures. It kills our construction coach when he has to help us build a structure that is not strong and, you know, perfectly made. So he kind of steps back and offers support while we build that sukkah here. But that's part of the point, is that we are recognizing for a week that this is a temporary structure. And in so doing, we are recognizing that there are people who don't have permanent structures, who don't have a house to go back to with, you know, a strong roof and indoor plumbing and heat and cool and so on. And this recognition of the fragility of housing for a lot of people is a very strong and powerful one for people who are celebrating Sukkot and who maybe don't encounter that very much. Tivnuniks come from all over the country. Some of them see a lot of unhoused people. Some of them don't ever see an unhoused person. And they come to Portland and are much more aware of it. And then a lot of what we do is working alongside people who are houseless. And we and our, you know, our whole first unit of study is really looking at housing justice and poverty and how these are related. And Sukkot is this crucible for studying and contemplating that, which anyone can do. You don't have to be on the Tivnu gap year to build a sukkah or sit in somebody's sukkah and think about how crucial it is for everyone to be housed and to have a permanent house that is stronger and more stable and more sheltering than a sukkah is. And it's a moment of gratitude for what you've got, and it's a moment of recognition that we don't all have it. Even within our small Tivnu community, there are people who've struggled with housing insecurity and people who've struggled with food insecurity. And sometimes people think that's not in the Jewish community, but it is. It's part of our community as well. Yeah.
Tell me a little more about the young people that are coming to Portland to do this work for a year, usually between high school and then whatever comes after high school, college, or the variety of different paths a person can take. What's sort of the common motivator?
There are a lot of different reasons people come to TVNU. Some people come because they've been working really hard for, let's say, 12 years of schooling, and they expect to work pretty hard when they get to what's next, college or university, which is what the majority of our graduates do. And they want some time to kind of take a breather, to learn for learning's sake and not for a grade and not for a GPA and not for a resume and a college application, right? Mm-hmm. There's no standardized testing for TVNU. I cannot even imagine what that would look like. Some people come because they feel like Jewishly they haven't exactly found who they are. And it's a chance to be on their own and not just do what their parents say, but at the same time be in a supportive community that offers lots of Jewish options. We take it pretty seriously at TVNU that this is a chance for people to see Jewishness in a way they haven't seen before. So for Rosh Hashanah, we have a Seder for Rosh Hashanah, which a lot of people have never heard of. It goes back to the Talmud, but it's mostly an Eastern Jewish tradition, Mizrahi Jews from Arab lands and so on. And we put a TVNU spin on it. So instead of puns in Aramaic over all the foods on the Seder plate, we do puns in English, and it's a little more accessible that way. But, you know, if you've never been to a Seder Rosh Hashanah, which is 98% of the people who are hearing me right now, probably.
Myself included.
All right. Then it's a chance to say, oh, there's some things in Jewish that I didn't know about. When we study social justice things from a Jewish perspective, that's not always like taking out a page of Talmud or the Bible to try and understand the Jewish text. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's looking at Jewish historical examples or a poem or a piece of writing from Jewish literature or a movie or something like that. And so we want to really give them a chance to kind of see the full buffet and figure out where are they connecting. What do they want to explore more, and what is going to be their way into Jewishness? So some people come for that. Some people come for TVNU because they really like the opportunity to have these internships. You generally have one internship for the whole 9 months, mm-hmm. as opposed to some programs where you would like volunteer here for 2 weeks and then here for a week and there for 3 weeks. This is a chance for the young people to really dig in. They get to know the people they're working with, both the staff and the clients or the members of the community. They get to increase their knowledge and deepen their responsibilities, and they get a chance to see a window into a kind of professional path that they might be interested in. You know, we had somebody who thought she wanted to go into education, and so she came and she worked at Boise Elliott Elementary School, and it helped guide her in her major afterwards. She ended up coming back to TVNU as an RA, actually.
Nice.
But some people really like that opportunity professionally, kind of, and to make friends. They make nice friends. They get to see the Pacific Northwest. Some of them really love the hiking or the rafting or the, you know, visit to the coast or whatever it is. So people come for lots of different reasons.
Outstanding. Well, speaking of looking at Jewish practices and ideas and through a different lens, perhaps, how does one approach homelessness and food insecurity and other basic need insecurities through a Jewish lens? What is the particular Jewish perspective on that?
Yeah,
at least from your view.
That's a great question. You know, and some of the Jewish values that we talk about could be said to be kind of universal humanistic values, right? And some are pretty particular to Jewishness or to Jewish tradition. You know, in terms of food insecurity, there are lots of different connections. One is Shmirat HaGuf, which means taking care of the body, which is a principle in Jewish, but it's also a principle not in Jewish, right? The idea that you need to take good care of your body. The idea of all the different laws in the Torah and in rabbinic writings about harvesting and about taking care of the poor, the orphan, the widow, and leaving the corners of the fields and all of those kinds of things really teach us about kind of collective responsibility and community, mutual aid within a community. Jewish history teaches that as well. There are social safety nets in Jewish communities. If you look back at medieval and early modern communities, each little community would have several chevrot or societies that were responsible where, you know, if you had the money, you would contribute to education of children in poverty or to dowering the bride who couldn't afford a dowry or to burying the dead who couldn't afford a funeral. And then later, if you look at Jewish communities that had emigrated from, let's say, Eastern Europe to New York, Boston, Baltimore, whatever, they would have these things called Landsmannschaften, which just rolls off the tongue, I know. Yeah. Landsmannschaften, which are like hometown societies. So all the Jews from Bialystok in Boston had the Bialystoker Society, and they would also, it was a mutual aid society, they would put some money in, and then when they were starting a new business or cleaning up after a hurricane kind of a thing, they would take out what they needed, and then when they were back on their feet, they could put it back in. So this idea of like social safety nets and community responsibility is definitely there as part of both housing justice and food security. This connection to gratitude for the food you have and for the way you got it. I often think that when children learn the bracha, the blessing for a particular food, it's actually a chance for them to think a little bit about what's in the food. You know, like if there's a different one that you use for things that grow from the ground and a different blessing for things that grow from a tree, you know, and you have an avocado, you're like, oh, it's a vegetable. So you would say the one for things that grow from the ground. But of course, it grows from a tree. So you have to start to have some awareness of where food comes from. And that's a nice way in Jewishly to connect with food justice also. There's also questions about, you know, it says in the Torah, in the story of the Garden of Eden, that humans were put here to avodah l'shamra, to work the land and to guard it or take care of it. And there's a lot of environmental justice work that comes from that kind of a principle as well. So there are all kinds of connections. The Torah and rabbinic writings and modern Jewish writings have a lot to say about housing justice in terms of what constitutes a house. If you look at the laws for when you need to put a mezuzah on the door, what constitutes a room that you would put a mezuzah? What constitutes a house? You know, or other kinds of regulations that kind of tell us a little bit about what's considered housing. And then there are some laws about if evictions and landlord and tenant law, actually, that go all the way back to the Mishnah, you know, in the early couple of centuries of this era. So there is a lot to be found in Jewish tradition about these different issues.
Yeah. So what kind of impact has Tivnu's work had here in Portland, where housing and houselessness and housing insecurity seems to be one of our areas intractable problems?
Yeah, you know, I would turn it around and say, what has that, the impact of that been on Tivnu in a lot of ways? You know, we're here to work alongside the people who are living these experiences and follow their direction and hear what they think the solutions need to be, because an 18-year-old from Cleveland doesn't know the answer to houselessness in Portland, Oregon, right? Mm-hmm. What she can offer is her muscles, right, and her brains and her commitment and her resilience and her friendship, right? And working in solidarity with people who are experiencing it is more our model than trying to solve these intractable problems. But they've had a huge impact on our participants, right? Tiv Nunick's, I was thinking about a few years back when we were working at Agape Village, which is a tiny house village on church grounds, and helping to build the tiny houses there and working alongside people who were going to live there. Mm-hmm. That year, they all had lunch together. They, like, somebody cooked lunch, and they all ate lunch together in the middle of the workday. They'd build a little fire. And one of our participants said that he got a chance to talk to folks who were living outside, and a gentleman who had been in prison, and kind of just working alongside them for a common goal gave them a connection that never would have happened otherwise, and gave him a chance to have conversations with somebody he never would have encountered otherwise. And I think that that's, you know, part of the beauty of Tivnu is you get a chance to have real conversations with people from really outside your bubble, outside your experience, and to hear completely different perspectives on life. Because you're working together towards a common goal, you have an automatic connection and a way in that you wouldn't have otherwise. So I don't think Tivnu is going to solve this problem. It's a systemic issue. It has to do with the cost of housing and the availability of low-cost housing. It has to do with wages. It has to do with how we take care of people in our system or don't. And it has, you know, there are a lot of root causes. And
making friends with somebody who's been living outside isn't the solution, but it is a way to give idud, to give support, to give strength to people who are going to lead to those solutions. And I think that opening their eyes to kind of who these people are and what their experiences have been and what they have in common and what they don't, and really the dignity of the people that we're working with, I think is a chance for them to be in solidarity for the rest of their lives. Yeah. A beautiful thing about being in my position is that I have everyone's email address when they finish TVNU, and I hear from alumni a lot, and I cherish it. It's wonderful. And I found out last year how many TVNU alumni have gone into things like working on housing and policy, things like that, working on environmental studies, like who've really taken what happened for them at TVNU and made it a big part of their lives, Jewishly, academically, professionally, just in so many ways, community-wise, in so many ways that they're really taking the seeds that were planted, or, you know, honestly, they were probably planted before they got here, that we nourished a little bit, mm-hmm. and really seeing them flourish.
Well, that's a pretty big impact in and of itself, even if it's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of the coin, you have these young folks that get these contact with people that are dealing with these, as we describe them, intractable problems. But then for those folks, they get to work with and or they are able to work with and interact with on a meaningful level somebody that genuinely cares about them. That's mm-hmm. not nothing.
Yeah, I find that a lot of TVNUnics come in and they're like, I understand why we're learning about like housing in this country, or, you know, why we're looking about food insecurity in this country, but why do I care about Bortland? And then after a couple of months, they're like, but, you know, I care about this guy and I care about that woman, right? And then a few months in, they're like, I'm going canvassing for this issue because I really want this ballot measure to pass in Portland, in Oregon, in Metro, whatever it is.
It's not abstract anymore.
It's not. Yeah, we had a participant last year who was working at Boise Elliott Elementary during the big Portland teacher strike and got super involved. That they walked the picket line sometimes with their colleagues and got really involved in a lot of the issues facing Portland Public Schools. And they said to me, can I do TVNU for 4 years because I would like to establish residency and run for school board and straighten out the mess that I see out there. So some of them really do come to love and care about Portland. And in fact, we've had a number of participants who come back over their summer vacations and their winter vacations and volunteer either at the same organizations where they worked as interns during TVNU or even at new ones. We have somebody who's come back like every summer and a couple of winter breaks and tried out a bunch of different organizations that TVNU has worked with over the years. So he worked at Bikes for Humanity. He worked at Street Books. He worked at Kindness Farm. He's worked at all kinds of different wonderful organizations, which he's been connected to because of TVNU and really feels like it's part of his community now.
Outstanding. So what are some ways that folks can incorporate this focus on housing and social justice into their own Sukkot practices?
Yeah, that's a lovely question, because you don't have to be on a gap year to be involved in this. I think that one way is to really explore what hospitality looks like. You don't have to invite someone that you see on the street, you know, living in a tent into your sukkah, but to think about who in your community could use a little extra help and invite them into your life in some way. It may be someone that you buy a Street Roots newspaper from every week in front of your new seasons near you, you know. To have conversations with them, to hear what's going on in their lives. You know, it doesn't have to be a deep, meaningful relationship, but just to have some kind of relationship with people like that. And to think about what Sukkot would look like if you did invite someone like that into your home, into your, you know, your temporary dwelling place for the week. I think that kind of exploring topics of housing insecurity and the systemic problems that lead to it with your family is a great tabletop conversation for Sukkot. I think kind of having a greater awareness of local produce and how it's grown and how we relate to the land and how we relate to where our food comes from is another kind of topic that one can bring into their Sukkot practice. Some people make their own Arba Minim, their own four species, native to their land. So if palm trees and citron fruits and myrtles and willows are not native to where you're from, what would your four species look like, right? What would it look like to have a Pacific Northwest kind of four species? And so some people like to kind of be creative and bring that in and have a greater awareness of the natural world around them in that way. And to have your sukkah be a place of happiness, where we try to dwell in Tivnu, which is celebrating and giving gratitude for what we have while still acknowledging that there are big problems that we need to deal with. And I think Sukkot allows you to do that. It's a festival of happiness, but you also know this is, you know, that it's going to rain on you and the bees are going to come and that not everyone can afford a lulav and etrog because they're pretty expensive. And, you know, and to kind of bring that awareness of what the problems are, the injustices that we have in our society, while also finding room for hope and celebration in that community feeling.
Yeah. All right, we're going to have to go back to the bees. What is the story with the bees? There has to be a good story there.
Well, you know, if you have lots of fruit, and some of us still have apples and honey out from Rosh Hashanah, we keep going with that because it's good apple season and the honey is delicious, right? Mm-hmm. And if you string, you know, cranberries in your sukkah, you're going to have bees that come and celebrate Sukkot with you. And for those people who have to carry EpiPens because of that, it's not such a celebration.
No, not so much. What are some of your other favorite memories of Sukkot?
Well, I mean, the hopeless romantic in me remembers the first Sukkot when I brought my now husband, David, to meet my parents. It was during the holiday of Sukkot, and we have the tradition that many Jews have, before you say motzi, to the blessing for the bread, that you wash your hands ritually, and then you don't talk between the washing of the hands and the eating of the bread. And so during that time, we sometimes kind of lie, hum a song, whatever it is, and we were in that that kind of pause between the two in our sukkah, and my mom started lying a song, and David knew the dance to it, the dance moves for the Israeli dance to it, and he started dancing in the sukkah, and my mother's like, oh, this is the guy for you. He's got the Israeli dance moves, and it just breaks into Israeli dance. So that was something that happened in my sukkah 20-something years ago, and that's a lovely memory. But growing up, my parents really took the idea of Hidur mitzvah, which means kind of adding beauty to a commandment and the fulfillment of a commandment, they took it pretty seriously. And so our sukkah wasn't just decorated with like paper chains, which it's a fine sukkah decoration until it rains. And
then you've got mush chains.
The chains bleed their blues and reds all over. But my mom used to make banners, felt like fabric banners to hang in our sukkah, and it would be a quote from the Bible or something with an illustration, usually with a little humor in it. And so our whole sukkah was decorated with those, and my parents still have them, and my parents are actually coming to visit for Sukkot this year in Portland, and they are bringing some of their banners with them. So it's going to bring some of those nice childhood memories with them to our Portland sukkah.
Oh, that's going to be outstanding. Well, hug Sameah to you and yours, though it sounds like you've got that taken care of. Adina Miller, thank you so much for joining us on the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Rock. It's been a pleasure.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. Thank you so much to Adina Miller for sharing her perspective and to our associate editor, Kuron Blau-Rothstein, for her help bringing this episode together. You can learn more about Tivnu's work and programs here in Portland online at tivnu.org. That's T-I-V-N-U.org. If you're looking for information and resources this holiday season, check out the Federation's High Holy Days Happenings page online at jewishportland.org/High Holy Days Happenings. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to The Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review Podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Kuron Blau-Rothstein. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, hug Samaya and all the best.